All right. Good morning. Welcome to Bio 241. It's Thursday, April 19th. And on the screen, I guess I'm going to turn some of these lights down. On the screen, turn those off. And one of these right here. How about that one? That's too much. That doesn't work. Okay, so on the screen, let's look at the schedule over on the right-hand side. 19th, we're going to finish up muscle today, maybe get into blood and heart. Our next test is on May 8th, and we're going to take that test on May 8th, no matter what. Okay, but I don't know what chapters are going to be on the test, so you got to keep coming to class to know, because this is what kind of class schedule? It's a tentative class schedule, right? And the only way I know it's where it's too far away for me to tell you exactly what chapters are on the test. All right, I just remembered something that's interesting. Chapter 14 right here, somebody said they didn't have a study guide for. And tell you what, the study guide for chapter 14 is tucked in with the folder, inside the folder for exam number 5. So it is on Blackboard. You can start working on it whenever you want, okay? But it's in with exam 5 over here. That's why it's not so obvious in Blackboard, okay? Sorry about that. Probably should have been included in exam number 4. All right, so let's finish up with muscle, but before I start yakking about muscle, does anybody have any questions about muscle so far? I don't know, it's kind of fun because it's a little bit of a review from anatomy a little bit, right? That takes you back to those days of being in a really easy class. Okay, so the camera's readjusting itself. All right, so we got done talking about, which way am I going? Here we go. We talked about all this stuff right here, twitch and summation and tetanus. Oh, I remember what we're going to talk about. We were talking about fatigue last time. All right, so this right here is what we call physiologic fatigue. Oh, and too bad those psychology students left, because I wanted to ask you about psychological fatigue. Why is there such a thing as psychological fatigue? This is real physiologic fatigue right here. What did we say causes physiologic fatigue? Okay. When the muscle gets weaker and weaker and weaker, even though you're contracting it voluntarily, that's fatigue, right? And physiologic fatigue just means that when a muscle goes into tetanus, of course, blood can't get into that muscle, but ATP runs out. ADP starts to build up inside the cell. And hydrogen ions start to build up inside the cell. So the pH changes. So these are real biological changes that make the muscle get weaker and weaker. Can't operate at optimal conditions. So it gets weaker and weaker and weaker. That's physiologic fatigue. But what about psychological fatigue? And when you start exercising a muscle, right, strenuously, what happens? What does it feel like? Well, it starts to hurt, right? And so that's just, we call that pain inhibition. So sometimes muscles just get weaker and weaker because you lose the will to contract that muscle, right? Because it starts to hurt. So that is psychological fatigue, and that's buildup of lactic acid and hydrogen ions inside the cell, okay? And also, I suppose maybe the muscle is actually ripping apart at a microscopic level as well when you exercise very strenuously. That's going to produce pain, and anything that produces pain will produce psychological fatigue. All right, so that's fatigue. Let's look at a length-tension relationship of muscle. All right, so the strength of muscle contraction is influenced by a number of things. Right, even let's just think of a trained athlete that doesn't experience any kind of psychological fatigue. Right, so if you're a trained athlete and a muscle starts to hurt when you exercise it, then you're just going to keep exercising anyway. Right, okay. But let's consider this a trained athlete. The strength of muscle contraction is going to be influenced by the frequency of stimulation. So the more frequency of muscle, or the higher the frequency of muscle is stimulated at, then the tension is going to increase as a result of that. And I guess we could explain that because calcium builds up around inside the myofibril, and that's going to allow, okay, cross bridges to cycle. And when actin and myosin slide over each other, that's going to produce tension. So the frequency of stimulation increases tension. So it's a nice direct relationship there. There's also a direct relationship between the thickness of a muscle fiber and the tension that it can develop. Because as a muscle fiber gets bigger and bigger, then we can put more and more organelles of contraction inside that cell. So instead of maybe 5 organelles per contraction, we can put 20 or 30, so it's going to produce greater tension. And what the heck is the organelle of contraction inside a muscle cell? It's made out of sarcomeres, but I wouldn't say sarcomere necessarily. Sarcomere is the structural and functional unit of contraction, but the organelle inside a muscle fiber is a myofibril. Okay, so as a muscle cell gets bigger and bigger in diameter, there can be more myofibrils put into that fiber, so it gets stronger as a result. And then when you put more myofibrils, of course, you have more sarcomeres as well. All right, so that's pretty intuitive. Frequency and thickness are pretty intuitive, but this next item right here is not very intuitive at all until we think about it. And that is the initial length of a muscle fiber also determines what kind of tension can be produced by that muscle fiber. And athletes kind of know this because what do they do with muscles to make them stronger? Okay, not only do they contract them, but they stretch them as well. Okay, so the length produced by stretching increases, right, the strength of a muscle fiber's contraction. All right, so there's an ideal resting length, right, which can generate maximal force. So let's look at this graph right here. This is what we call a length-tension relationship. So here is tension on the vertical axis, relative tension, okay, versus the resting length of a muscle. And these numbers have been normalized because we say relative right here because not every muscle cell that people look at is exactly the same diameter. Some are bigger, some are smaller, and that would just produce a lot of noise in this graph right here. So it's just divided by whatever the diameter of that muscle fiber is that they're looking at. Okay, and then some muscles are longer than others, right? And again, this axis down over here is normalized. They're just divided by their resting length and then shown as a percentage of their resting length. So I don't think you have to be too concerned about that. So consider this a diagram of tension versus the resting length of a muscle fiber. Okay, and you can see that there is an optimum between 100 and 120% of the normal resting length of the muscle. And if you go on either side, what happens to tension that's produced by that muscle? It starts to go down. It starts to go down right here. So the resting length of a muscle does determine how strong that muscle is as measured by the tension. And how can we explain that? All right, so how does a muscle shorten? What has to happen? The actin and myosin have to slide over each other, and that sliding is produced by those cross bridges that are forming, right, that are flexing, extending, and grabbing myosin again and going through that cycle. We call that cross bridge cycling. So there has to be an association between actin and myosin. So here we have a nice myosin molecule and actin, and we look at this sarcomere right here. It's going to be contracting with maximal force because we have a lot of overlap between actin and myosin, so that cross bridges can form. And we also have a lot of the I-band left, right, so that actin and myosin can actually slide over each other because there's a lot of free space right here. All right, so when the sarcomere is at this length right here, which is like greater than its resting length, it's at about 120% of its resting length right here, the sarcomere can shorten and it produces a lot of tension. All right, well, let's take this sarcomere and stretch it out. Or maybe we could take one of your muscles and stretch it out, do some stretching exercises. And if we stretch a muscle out, let's look at this condition way out over here, okay, where we're almost at 200% of its resting length. We've doubled the length of that muscle. And when we super stretched a muscle, look, there's no overlap between the actin and myosin molecules. It's true, there's a lot of space right here that myosin can slide over in and contract, but can this sarcomere contract at all? Because there is no overlap, there can be no association between myosin and actin, the cross bridges can't form, so this particular sarcomere can't produce any tension at all. It's very weak because why? It is overstretched. It's too stretched, right? So then that muscle has to go back, and the elastic properties of the muscle, of course, will pull these back together to its normal length. Or if we look at a muscle fiber, okay, that is shortened up, okay, right here, it's only at maybe 70% of its resting length. we see that there's plenty of overlap between actin and myosin, so there can be a lot of cross bridges that form. But can the filaments slide over each other anymore? No, because the myosin right here fills up the entire sarcomere. Even though cross bridges can form, the filaments can't slide over each other, and this sarcomere produces very little tension as well. All right, so in order to produce maximal tension, there has to be just an optimal overlap of actin and myosin filaments, and that's anywhere between 100 and 120% of its normal resting length right here. So if you want really strong muscles, you have to be operating in this region right here. So stretching muscles is a good way to increase muscle strength. And we call that the length-tension relationship. That's going to be really important to remember when we get to the next chapters in the heart, because heart muscle is similar to skeletal muscle. Does anybody remember how is it similar to skeletal muscle? It is striated as well, which means that it is made out of sarcomeres, just like skeletal muscle. Okay, so stretching of the heart is real important. It will produce a strong heart or a weak heart depending on the state of stretch of the myocardium or the heart. All right, let's look at some neural control of skeletal muscles. All right, so the motor neuron cell bodies are in the ventral horn of the spinal cord. All right, then that is opposed to the anterior horn. And then the axons leave out through the ventral root. So the ventral root is the motor root leaving the spinal cord. What's the afferent root in the spinal cord? Okay. Motor is the same thing as efferent. Afferent is sensory. And what root is the sensory root in the spinal cord? I'm just trying to shock your mind into remembering some good stuff so that it all comes flooding back to you. All right, the dorsal root is sensory and the ventral root is motor, so that makes perfect sense for what you know already. Okay, and that neuron that leaves the spinal cord is what we call a lower motor neuron. And it only takes one neuron to get from the spinal cord, which is central nervous system, all the way to that skeletal muscle fiber. Right? It just takes one. And we call that the final common pathway, because other neurons can synapse on the cell body in that ventral horn right here and influence the activity of that neuron going to that skeletal muscle. Right, and so that activity is influenced by feedback from muscles and tendons, and also maybe from psychological factors. For instance, if that muscle is hurting, then that neuron can be inhibited by your conscious thought. Okay, so there can be facilitatory and inhibitory activity from upper motor neurons, even as high up as the cerebrum in your brain, that can influence the activity of that lower motor neuron right there. All right, so to control skeletal muscle movements, the nervous system must receive feedback on the length of muscles, right, and the tension that is being produced in muscles. So remember, any kind of response loop, okay, starts with a stimulus, ends in a response, and then in order to maintain homeostasis, what's the relationship between the response and the stimulus? Somehow they're added together, right? There has to be receptors that can tell your brain how your muscles are behaving to really know if your body is behaving or not so that it can make corrections. And the information that's presented to the spinal cord, actually your central nervous system, your spinal cord, or your brain, is the length of a muscle or the tension that's being produced in that muscle. So all of your muscles are sending information to your spinal cord and brain as to what their length is and tension is. So there are receptors in these muscles. The receptor for length is what we call a muscle spindle apparatus. These are embedded in all skeletal muscles. And tension information is given to your central nervous system by Golgi tendon organs. And these you find where? In tendons. What the heck is a tendon once again? It's a muscle bone connection, right? And it transmits tension that's being produced by muscle into the bone so that bones move in your body, right? And that's why we call them skeletal muscles, because they move your skeleton around. All right, so you got two kinds of receptors for length and for tension. Spindle apparatus for length, Golgi tendon organs for tension. And here we see a bone and a tendon and a muscle, and embedded in this muscle right here is a muscle spindle apparatus, which is going to be measuring the length of this muscle right here. All right, so we can't really see it with our naked eye. That's just an artist's depiction of it. So let's use a microscope and zoom into this region right here, and it looks something like this. All right, so these are cells, and of course you can't see cells with your naked eye, so this is a really small apparatus. You can see some typical kinds of skeletal muscle cells right here, and you know these are nice skeletal muscle cells. How do you know these are nice skeletal muscle cells? Yeah, they're striated, and they're linear. They're not branched, so they're not cardiac muscles, right? So these are nice skeletal muscles. And these are the ones that contract and produce tension and move your body around. These are what we call extrafusal fibers. These are the regular muscles that you use all day long to move your body around, extrafusal fibers. And then here is the receptor for length in a muscle. This is the muscle spindle apparatus, and it's surrounded by a connective tissue sheath right here. And on the inside of that connective tissue sheath, there are some modified muscle cells. And we call these things intrafusal fibers. So extrafusal are outside the spindle apparatus, intrafusal are inside. And you can see some of these have striations on them as well, which mean that they can contract as well. They can shorten. They can't produce tension like an extrafusal fiber, but they can at least shorten. Okay. All right, so here we have a couple motor neurons. We have some that go to the extrafusal fibers. We see right here, I can see a nice motor end plate right here. And this is what we call an, this is just the gamma fiber. Well, that goes to the intrafusal fibers. The alpha motor neuron goes to the extrafusal fiber. So this alpha fiber right here is what you normally use for contracting muscles in your body. And the gamma fiber right here goes to the intrafusal fiber and adjusts the length of the spindle apparatus. All right, so in order for your central nervous system to know if these extrafusal fibers are doing their job, there has to be a receptor, which is right here. Okay, so when you send a signal to a muscle to contract, it comes down the alpha motor neuron right here and causes these extrafusal fibers to contract, and at the same time, there are action potentials that come down the gamma motor neuron, and it causes the intrafusal fibers to contract to the proper length that a motion is going to require. Okay, so it's going to contract along with the extrafusal fibers. These extrafusal fibers right here don't have any receptors to monitor how well they are contracting or stretching. But if we look at these intrafusal fibers, we see different kinds of receptors. And I don't want you to know the different kinds of receptors, but these are stretch receptors. All right, we have some, okay, that kind of look like what we call a flower spray ending right here. Some are wrapping around the intrafusal fiber over here. But these are special mechanoreceptors that can monitor the stretch of these fibers right here. All right, so let's just say this is the biceps. So you tell your biceps to contract. So the alpha motor neuron tells the biceps to contract. And the gamma motor neuron right here tells the muscles within the spindle apparatus to contract. They should contract together, right? And it's the job of these extrafusal fibers right here to produce the work for you. Right, and then these intrafusal fibers contract to the proper length. All right, so the intrafusal fibers are at the proper length, and if the extrafusal fibers contract to the proper length, right, so both are at the proper length, what is the error that is occurring if they're both at the proper length? Okay, then there is no error signal, and the spindle apparatus is not stretched at all. So these stretch receptors within the spindle apparatus don't send any information back to the central nervous system via these afferent fibers right here. And I'm not going to ask you to know primary and secondary, but these just have to do with a different rate of change. Some are very sensitive right at the beginning of a muscle contraction, and others are more tonic. Okay, so if there is no error, then there are no signals going back to the central nervous system. All right, but what happens if you tell a muscle to contract, and all muscles in your body right now are contracted to some degree, some more maximally than others. But all of a sudden, something unexpectedly stretches a muscle and pulls your body out of position. All right, so these extrafusal fibers are going to start to stretch. They don't have any receptors, but since the muscles within the spindle apparatus have been contracted to the proper length, they start to stretch, and then these stretch receptors, okay, become activated and send signals back to the central nervous system saying that this whole muscle is beginning to stretch. It's no longer at the proper length. Okay, and then your body makes a decision on what to do with this muscle to protect joints and muscles, and that usually is to contract the muscle to counteract the stretch that is taking place. All right, so that is a nice negative feedback mechanism to make sure that your central nervous system knows what position your body is in and how muscles are contracting properly. All right, so the gamma motor fiber and the alpha motor fiber right here activate both the extrafusal fibers and the intrafusal fibers at the same time, and we call that co-activation. And that's important because if the intrafusal fibers don't become activated, if they don't go to the proper length, if they stay in a very long length and the muscle starts to stretch, then they won't be stretched, right, if they're relaxed. It's only when they're at the proper length and then they're stretched that these stretch receptors can send information back to the central nervous system. Okay, so you got alphas to the extrafusal fibers, gammas to the intrafusal fibers, and the only place where you have stretch receptors is inside of the spindle apparatus, which is inside this connective tissue sheath right here. All right, so upper motor neurons usually stimulate both the alpha and gamma neurons simultaneously. We call that co-activation. And activity of the gammas maintains normal muscle tone in skeletal muscles all over your body. So let's look at a reflex regarding the spindle apparatus. All right, so here we have a nice femur and a tibia right here. Here's a patellar ligament which goes to the patella. And then we have the tendon of the quadriceps attached to the quadriceps muscle right here. And we have alpha motor neurons, okay, going to the skeletal muscle fibers, the extrafusal fibers of the quadriceps right here. And then we have sensory neurons from the muscle spindle, okay, coming in the dorsal root. So if your thigh is in the proper position, like right now, you're just sitting on a chair, right, and your knee is bent, and then all of a sudden something happens, maybe you fall out of the chair, or a friend does something to you, push, kind of hits you on the shoulder and stretches this muscle, or for instance, maybe you're seeing a physician and they stretch the patellar ligament right here with just a little tap of this rubber mallet, which puts tension on the patella, which puts tension on the tendon here, stretches the quadriceps, which then stretches the spindle apparatus because it's been co-activated with the extrafusal fibers. Then these stretch receptors are going to send action potentials to the central nervous system. So here's that nice pseudo-unipolar neuron coming in the dorsal root, synapses directly on the cell body of an alpha motor neuron in the ventral gray horn, right, which then sends action potentials down the alpha motor neuron, not to the intrafusal fibers, but to the extrafusal fibers to contract this quadriceps muscle. But what was the initial stimulus? Was stretching, okay? And so what does contraction do? Does it add to or does it subtract from the stimulus? It subtracts from the stimulus. So what kind of feedback loop is this right here? It's a negative feedback loop. And what does a negative feedback loop produce? Yeah, homeostasis. It maintains this muscle in the proper length right here to maintain the health of these joints and the health of the tendon and the muscle itself as a result of that. So this is what we call a monosynaptic reflex, and in particular a monosynaptic stretch reflex, because I want you to link up stretch with what kind of receptor? The spindle apparatus right here. So a monosynaptic stretch reflex, we call it that because there's only one synapse between the sensory neuron and this motor neuron, which is going to protect this muscle right here. And we call this also the knee-jerk reflex. Okay, so that kind of reflex can be monitored to understand Okay, the health of the spindle apparatus, the health of this sensory neuron, right? Is it getting into the spinal cord, and the health of the spinal cord, and also the health of this motor neuron right here. If somebody doesn't have a knee-jerk reflex, then of course there's something wrong with the system. Maybe it's a spinal cord injury or something like that. Okay, Golgi tendon organ reflex is a little bit different. It's a disynaptic reflex. All right, and the spindle apparatus measures what kind of response or what kind of stimulus? Yeah, stretch. The Golgi tendon organ doesn't measure stretch, it measures tension within tendons in your body. So here is a Golgi tendon organ, and we're not going to look at the structure, the internal structure of the Golgi tendon apparatus, but it can measure tension within this tendon right here. And it is a disynaptic reflex. All right, so for instance, maybe you're helping out a friend over the weekend move some furniture around, or maybe a refrigerator or something like that. How heavy is a refrigerator?
Heavy.
Yeah, heavy. You don't want to drop it on your toe, right? For sure. So you're trying really hard not to drop this stuff because you don't want to drop a TV set either, right? So you and your friend are carrying some heavy furniture around, and you're lucky because you're walking forwards. And what about your friend? Poor sucker is walking backwards, right? Okay, too bad for him. And all of a sudden, he loses his grip on whatever you're carrying, like that refrigerator, okay? And it slides out of his hand. So who's holding up the whole refrigerator? You are holding up the whole refrigerator. So now you have all of this weight on your body, and what can that do to your musculoskeletal system? It can start to rip tendons and muscles and things like that, right? But you have these Golgi tendon organs right here that says, hey, wait a second. You are lifting way too much weight. You're going to damage me and the muscle and your back and everything else. So it sends action potentials into the spinal cord via this nice afferent neuron right here, in through what root? The dorsal root of the spinal cord. That comes in to the gray matter where it synapses on an interneuron. And remember, an interneuron is a neuron or an association neuron completely found within the central nervous system. It has no part in the peripheral nervous system, because here's the cell body, here's the axon terminus, so that's a nice association neuron. The sensory neuron stimulates this association neuron and makes a decision and says, oh yeah, for sure, you know, we're damaging this muscle right here. I better pass that information on. And it releases inhibitory neurotransmitter on this alpha motor neuron, which is going to the extrafusal fibers right here to contract the muscle. And so what does inhibitory neurotransmitter do to this alpha motor neuron? Yeah, it stops sending action potentials to the skeletal muscle. And then what happens to the skeletal muscle? It relaxes, it stops contracting, and then you drop the refrigerator. Okay, too bad for the refrigerator, but at least you didn't damage your body. Right, and that happens all without your conscious thought. So the Golgi tendon organ reflex is a disynaptic reflex. The muscle spindle stretch reflex is just a monosynaptic reflex. And in your spinal cord right here, you can see it's making decisions for your body to protect it from damage. But does it produce any consciousness? Right, this all happens very quickly, just in less than a blink of an eye without your consciousness to protect your body. But also don't forget there are other sensory neurons that take information up the spinal cord, okay, to your brain to, of course, make you realize what's happening. But you would have your knee jerks and you would have dropped that refrigerator even before you realize what's happening, because it takes time for those action potentials to reach the cerebral cortex. All right, so Golgi tendon reflex prevents excessive muscle contraction. All right, that's its job. The stretch reflex right here prevents overstretching of muscle. Actually, it maintains the proper length of a muscle. That's its job. Okay, now the other thing is, we talked about special senses earlier in the class. Okay, I think we did. Yeah, we talked about what, eye, and that was on the last test. What kind of sense is vision? It's special. Why is that? Because you only have one or two highly organized organs for that sense. What's another special sense? Hearing, because, again, you only have one region in your body that can hear. You can't hear with your knuckles, right, or your thumbs or anything. Taste, right, gustatory sense, olfactory sense. What about this sense right here from the Golgi tendon organ and from the stretch reflex? Is this a general sense or a special sense?
General.
Okay. It seems like it should be special because of these specially organized organs right here, but you have these all over your body, every muscle, every tendon, right? So it is a general sense. It's a special sense. And that sense is what we call proprioception. So proprioception is a general sense because you have receptors all over the body. Even though it might sound like it should be special, it's not. It's a general sense. All right, let's take a quick look at some other types of muscle, namely cardiac and smooth. They're kind of lumped together right here because they're both involuntary, although they share some characteristics with skeletal muscle. All right, so what do we have right here? This is a nice example of, I'll erase the title of the slide, because you should be able to recognize this without looking at the title. Okay, it's striated and it's highly branched. Okay, and it has these junctions between the cells. These cells are relatively short, striated, and branched, so this is an example of cardiac muscle, right, that make up the myocardial layer, or the myocardium of the heart. And so, since it's striated, you know what the structural and functional unit of contraction is in these cells right here, which is a sarcomere. It's a sarcomere, okay? And these cells are short. All of these cells are going to contract, and the cell on the left might pull away from the cell on the right, so there's a special junction between them called an intercalated disc, which glues these cells together very tightly. Another part of an intercalated disc is a sodium channel, and we call that a gap junction. All right, so let's just say that we stimulate the cell on the left. What's a good way that we can stimulate the cell, that we can excite the cell right here? What can we inject into the cell to excite it?
Sodium.
Yeah, we can inject sodium into the cell. What is the cell going to do? Electrically, then, it's going to depolarize because of that sodium, right? And so it's going to contract when it depolarizes because there are voltage-gated channels everywhere on the cell membrane right here. And that sodium is going to then diffuse into this cell over here, right, go down its concentration gradient, because we're sodium at a low concentration, typically inside the cell. So if we put high sodium over here, it's going to diffuse into this one through these gap junctions. And what's going to happen to the cell on the right then as a result? It's going to become depolarized and excited. It's going to contract, right? Okay. So we don't have to stimulate all of the cells of the myocardium to get it contracted. We just have to stimulate one. And that depolarization is going to flow from one cell to another, right, at least in one layer. But because these myocardial cells are branched, what's going to happen? Depolarization is going to go from the superficial layer down into the next deeper layer, and then down into the next deeper layer, and then the whole wall thickness is going to become depolarized and contract. So when the heart contracts, it contracts as a unit. Every single cell contracts within the myocardium. Okay, and that's a wonderful thing because that's what has to happen in order for it to pump blood. Would it be good for skeletal muscles to have gap junctions? Obviously not, because if you contract your thumb muscle, then what would happen? Every muscle in your body would contract. That would be really awkward, right? Okay, so no gap junctions in skeletal muscles, but yes, in myocardial muscle cells. And that's why myocardial cells are also branched, so that the whole wall thickness can contract at the same time. Okay. All right, so excitation-contraction coupling is a little bit different in cardiac muscle. All right, we still have sarcoplasmic reticulum that is a reservoir for what ion?
Calcium.
All right, we still have sarcomeres. We still have actin and myosin in cardiac muscle, and cross bridges still have to form in order for these filaments to slide over each other. All right, and how is it, what allows a myosin head group to associate itself with an actin right here? What has to happen? Calcium has to bind to a troponin, right? And then troponin gets tropomyosin out of the way, so it's the same kind of mechanism, right? Maybe these troponins and tropomyosins aren't exactly the same as in skeletal muscle. They might be a little bit different form, but we still call them the same thing. We call them isomers. They're very, very similar. Okay. So on the surface of a myocardial cell, there are voltage-gated sodium channels. So when an action potential flows over, that opens this sodium channel. That produces an action potential over here because that opens up more sodium channels. All right. But within the transverse tubule of cardiac muscle cells, there are voltage-gated calcium channels. Remember, where is calcium normally at a high concentration? Outside the cell, right? So there's high calcium here, high calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So when this voltage-gated calcium channel opens, it goes inside the heart cell, right? And when that happens, when calcium builds up inside the cell, that opens up these calcium-induced calcium release channels. Skeletal muscle has these as well, but there's no ryanodine receptor. There's no physical coupling between these voltage-gated channels and this calcium-induced channel right here, which is different compared to skeletal muscle. These open purely because calcium is increasing within the cytosol of a myocardial cell. All right, and then that causes sliding of the myofilaments, and then, of course, the muscle cell contracts as a result. And then this calcium ATPase is always working. It's pumping calcium back into the cell. When there is no action potential in this transverse tubule, since calcium gets pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum and even outside of the cell, what happens to the heart muscle? It starts to relax because cross bridges can't form because tropomyosin is blocking the binding sites for the myosin head group right here. All right, so calcium is very important for maintaining muscle contraction and initiating muscle contraction in heart muscle, okay, because it allows for cross bridges right here. Okay, here is an example of smooth muscle, which is a little bit different. All right, I see myosin molecules and I see actin molecules over here, but I no longer see any striations because there's nothing like a Z disc or a Z line in smooth muscle. There are little points in space that are located right on the surface of a smooth muscle cell that we call dense bodies. Okay, so a dense body will have numerous actin molecules bound to it, right? But not in the same sense as the same repeating pattern that you would see producing striations in skeletal muscle. All right, so here is a contractile element that is projecting itself off to the left. Here's another one that's projecting above it. Okay, and then there are more projecting over here to the right. So these contractile elements just kind of have a random orientation right on the surface of this smooth muscle cell. But since they're actin and myosin, and the myosin has a head group right here, okay, it can be activated by calcium. These filaments can slide over each other, so when a smooth muscle contracts, it is the dense bodies that get pulled together, not the sarcomere. So this smooth muscle cell contracts from end to end, but it also contracts in the middle as well. It kind of just, the whole cell just kind of shrinks, as opposed as contracting from end to end. Okay, so you should know that smooth muscle has dense bodies that anchors the actin filaments, all right, and not Z discs. And notice that the myosin head groups right here are more tightly packed in this myosin molecule. And this ATPase in the myosin head group is a little bit different as well. It's a lot slower. Okay, it can still hydrolyze ATP, right? It can still cock the head group right here, but it's a lot slower. So that should tell you that the contraction of smooth muscle is slower as well compared to cardiac or skeletal muscle. Okay, so smooth muscle is controlled by calcium, but it's a little bit different compared to cardiac and smooth muscle. Smooth muscle has no troponin or tropomyosin. Okay, it still has actin and myosin, but no troponin and tropomyosin. And calcium enters through voltage-gated channels in the plasma membrane. Okay, which means, though, that smooth muscle has no sarcoplasmic reticulum loaded with calcium. So calcium comes primarily from extracellular sources. It's not from inside the smooth muscle cell. Okay, in skeletal muscle cell, the calcium comes mostly from sarcoplasmic reticulum. In cardiac muscle, it's from an extracellular source and sarcoplasmic reticulum. And smooth muscle is pretty much exclusively extracellular. All right, so that's the difference between all the different kinds of types of muscles. All right, so calcium doesn't bind to troponin, but smooth muscle has that older form of protein that can bind calcium, which is the cousin molecule to troponin, which is calmodulin. So it binds to calmodulin, and then calmodulin can activate various kinds of enzymes, and one of the enzymes that it activates is what we call myosin light chain kinase. So what does this enzyme do? It phosphorylates something, right? Because it's a kinase. That's what I would like for you to see by the definition. It's a kinase. It phosphorylates something. And what it phosphorylates is the light chain on myosin. And this is not a chain that's like a flashlight that shines light on something. It's the light chain, meaning that it's smaller. It's not the heavy part to the myosin group. Right? And when this particular protein becomes phosphorylated, it goes from an inactive form to an active form. And then it can form cross bridges with actin. And if there's ATP present, then these cross bridges can cycle and pull actin and myosin across each other. All right, so let's take a look at this diagram right here, and then I'll go back to a couple of these word slides. So here we have a graph of membrane potential across a smooth muscle cell. We're measuring the voltage across the cell membrane. And we can see that there are some rhythmic changes in membrane potential, these waves right here. And so this wave right here would be what kind of wave? Okay, it's depolarization, right? It's subthreshold though, yeah, so it's a subthreshold depolarization. And then there's some repolarization. And then it depolarizes again a little bit more, right? So this is not an action potential, right? Because these are at different amplitudes, so these are what we call graded depolarizations. And then finally, this third wave right here produces a sufficient depolarization that reaches threshold that will trigger voltage-gated channels to produce action potentials. And then what happens to these action potentials? They flow over the whole smooth muscle cell, okay, causing depolarization of the whole smooth muscle cell. And then that depolarization opens up voltage-gated calcium channels in the plasma membrane. And where is calcium at a high concentration? Outside the cell. So where does it go? Inside the cell, where it binds to calmodulin. So here is a calmodulin-calcium complex. And that is going to, okay, wait a second. Is that right compared to that slide? I just noticed something. Calmodulin complex activates myosin light chain kinase. Okay. Ah, okay. Here's myosin light chain kinase. This is an enzyme. Okay. And it is phosphorylated. This calmodulin calcium complex dephosphorylates myosin light chain kinase. And when it does, it changes conformation. And that slide was correct. Right? It's the unphosphorylated form of myosin light chain kinase, which is the active form. All right, so this calmodulin complex dephosphorylates myosin light chain kinase, which becomes active. So what does myosin light chain kinase do? Since it's a kinase, it's going to phosphorylate something. And the name right here tells us what it's going to phosphorylate. It's going to phosphorylate the myosin molecule. So here is myosin light chain right here. It becomes phosphorylated. Here you can see the phosphate. Okay, and now it becomes activated as a result. So then cross bridges can form, and when cross bridges form, what happens? The muscle shortens, the smooth muscle shortens. All right, but slowly, because this myosin light chain right here has a very slow ATPase in it. Okay, all right, so that causes muscle contraction. So calcium is the signal for smooth muscle contraction, and when these action potentials go away, all right, what happens? Well, then calcium no longer is being released to the inside of the cell, so these voltage-gated calcium channels close. All right, and then there's another enzyme, myosin phosphatase. Myosin phosphatase chops off this phosphate right here, because that's what a phosphatase does. It dephosphorylates something. It dephosphorylates this myosin light chain. So then cross bridges can't form as a result of that. All right, and when cross bridges can't form, then that smooth muscle cell starts to relax. All right, until another action potential comes along and starts that process all over again. All right, so you can see that's why we mentioned phosphorylation of phosphatases and kinases is very important for controlling enzyme activity. Right, and here we can see how controlling enzyme activity by phosphorylating or dephosphorylating various enzymes can result in contraction of smooth muscle. So that's a pretty nice example, right? A direct example of how phosphorylation can produce a nice physiologic effect like contraction of smooth muscle. So let's go back to this previous slide right here. All right, so relaxation, well, here is contraction. We talked about that one already. Right, relaxation occurs when calcium concentration decreases because these voltage-gated channels start to close when there are no action potentials going over the smooth muscle cell. Then myosin is dephosphorylated by myosin phosphatase, which is always active inside the cell. Okay, myosin can no longer form cross bridges as a result. Right, and the muscle starts to relax. Smooth muscle contracts much more slowly than striated muscle, okay, because of the ATPase is a different kind of enzyme, and the myosin ATPase is much slower. And smooth muscle can also form what we call a latched state, sort of like rigor that we see in skeletal muscle, where myosin can bind to actin for long periods of time, and it requires very little energy to do that. Of course, like in a rigor condition, that doesn't require any energy whatsoever. Skeletal muscles can't produce a latch state because there's always plenty of ATP inside a skeletal muscle cell, at least in a living skeletal muscle cell. But smooth muscle can get into this almost like it's a quasi-dead state, right, where actin and myosin can't unlatch from each other, so smooth muscle can stay in a contracted condition for long periods of time. And what period of time could I be thinking about as being a really long period of time? How about gestation? And that poor cervix right there has to stay contracted for how long? Long time. Months, right? Months and months and months. Okay? And they can do that without requiring a lot of energy. All right? So no doubt that's got to be, what, the strongest muscle in the body. Okay. Smooth muscle comes in two general types. There's single unit and multi-unit smooth muscle. We saw that some smooth muscle is what we call myogenic. It is spontaneously active because it can produce these waves of depolarization right here. Right? So single unit is spontaneously active. Some cells are pacemakers. Some depolarize more quickly than others. And so that just means then that they can control contraction in their neighborhood of all the smooth muscle cells around them because there are gap junctions between these smooth muscle cells. So when one cell within a group depolarizes or reaches threshold, then that produces threshold depolarizations in all the muscle cells around them because sodium can move through these gap junctions. So all of these cells can act as just a single muscle fiber. And since they can act as a single muscle fiber, we call that a single unit type of smooth muscle. All right, multi-unit smooth muscle requires nerve stimulation via the autonomic nervous system. What can you tell me about the ANS? How many divisions does it have? It's got two, right? There's sympathetic and parasympathetic, and they're antagonistic to each other. So one division might be excitatory and the other will be inhibitory on smooth muscle. And so these different neurons can release neurotransmitter, not just from the axon terminus, but from a series of synapses along the length of an axon. And we call that a varicosity. So here we see autonomic motor neuron, and the axon terminus is way down over here, but these little swellings right here along the axon contain synaptic vesicles, which will fuse to the presynaptic membrane right here and release neurotransmitter along the whole length of the axon. And so these are what we call varicosities, and when they make this nice long string of pearls right here, we call these synapses in passant, meaning that as an action potential passes through each of these varicosity It releases neurotransmitter, which then can have effect on these smooth muscle cells. Okay, now what kind of smooth muscle cells are these by function? Okay, are these single unit or multi-unit? Do they all contract together or can they contract independently of each other? And that's going to be determined by gap junctions. If it has gap junctions, how are these muscles going to operate? Independently or all as a unit? All as a single unit, right? So I see gap junctions right here. So this would be a good example of a single unit smooth muscle. Where we find this would be in the digestive tract, where there are waves of peristalsis, and so there are whole regions within the digestive tract that should contract together, okay, to move material through the digestive tract, okay, and then move as a wave down the digestive tract to move material through the digestive system. Okay, here would be an example of multi-unit smooth muscle. And that would be, for instance, in the eye, the ciliary body, the ciliary muscle. And the ciliary muscle, okay, has dual innervation. So here is an example of a sympathetic neuron. Here would be an example of a parasympathetic neuron. They both have varicosities that pass by these cells. And the sympathetic neuron will release excitatory neurotransmitter, and the parasympathetic neuron will release inhibitory neurotransmitter. And then here is an interesting muscle cell, this smooth muscle cell right here, compared to skeletal muscle. So let's take a skeletal muscle. When the motor neuron to skeletal muscle releases neurotransmitter, what can the skeletal muscle do? Because the neuromuscular junction is so big, so much acetylcholine is released on that skeletal muscle, it always contracts, can never make up its mind what to do. It always depolarizes to threshold, which causes contraction. On this smooth muscle cell right here, look at what it can do. It can look at excitatory neurotransmitter, and it can compare that signal with inhibitory neurotransmitter, and what can it do? It can decide whether it should contract or not. Right, so that's totally different compared to skeletal muscle, because some of these will produce IPSPs and some will produce EPSPs, right, and those graded potentials then can cancel each other out and the predominant form can win out and maybe cause contraction or maybe not cause contraction. Right, and that can happen just on each of these individual muscle cells right here. Okay, so that's it for muscle. Skeletal muscle, cardiac, and then a little bit here on smooth. And we have this as an exam figure. That's a pretty important exam figure because it shows how important phosphorylation is in terms of controlling activity of enzymes. And the activity of enzymes then is directly related into physical properties of your body, like muscle contraction, for instance. Okay, so that's it for this chapter. And I have some opening comments for the next chapter, which is blood, right here. We didn't talk about blood too much in anatomy, depending on exactly the semester. Okay, so let's just get an introduction of the circulatory system and blood out of the way for next time. All right, so the functions of the circulatory system, these are probably pretty obvious to you now. All right, it transports oxygen. In particular, what kind of cell inside the circulatory system transports oxygen? Okay, that is going to be red blood cells because they're loaded with a compound called hemoglobin that can carry oxygen. The blood also carries nutrients around. Like, give me an example of what's your favorite nutrient in the blood? I would probably say glucose, because you know a lot about glucose regulation right now. That's an important nutrient. Enzymes, we haven't studied enzymes very much in the blood, but we're going to look at some very important enzymes. Enzymes, as you saw, were important for controlling muscle contraction, and they're very important in blood because under normal circumstances, what kind of connective tissue is blood? Is it strong and tough like a tendon or bone? It's really strange. It's a fluid connective tissue. It can flow from one part of your body. But under certain circumstances, it shouldn't be a fluid because it will just run right out of your body. It should turn into a solid. And there are enzymes that control that process, right? So there's got to be definitely enzymes in blood, all right? And of course, hormones are transported in the blood because that's part of their definition, all right? It also is important for transporting waste products, like carbon dioxide is a waste product from metabolism and other kinds of waste products, right? And it blood also can carry temperature, can carry heat from one part of your body to another, right? So it's important for maintenance of body temperature. It can take extra heat from muscles that are exercising, carry it to your integument so that you can radiate that heat out of your body so you don't become hyperthermic. Blood also maintains fluid and electrolyte balance and also pH balance. There are buffers in blood that maintain the pH of your body. And what the heck's an electrolyte? Yeah, like sodium, calcium. Hard to know anymore what your favorite one would be. Okay, maybe calcium. And also the blood's important because it protects your body from disease-causing microorganisms. There are other kinds of blood cells called white blood cells that fight infection, part of your immune response. All right, so not only does it fight against foreign objects in your body, but also objects that are misbehaving like tumors. And we all probably have tumors in our body that are trying to grow, but these white blood cells are recognizing that tumor and destroying those cells before they get out of control. Okay, and unfortunately for some people, those tumors figure out a way to defeat your own natural immune system, and then they start to grow bigger and bigger and bigger, and then that becomes a problem. And it becomes even a bigger problem if those cells learn to break away from the tumor and go to other parts of your body to form other tumors. What do we call that process? Yeah, that's cancer or metastasis. So metastasis is the underlying function that's happening with cancer. Okay, and of course we mentioned just up here in terms of this enzyme, another really important function of blood is to prevent blood loss when a blood vessel is damaged. That connective tissue has to change its nature from being a fluid to a solid. All right, so the cardiovascular system or the circulatory system, right, includes the cardiovascular system, which is the heart and blood vessels, as well as the lymphatic system. So you have lymphatic vessels in your body. We'll take a look at those. So heart produces pressure in blood, which pumps blood through the cardiovascular system. Right, so what kind of vessel takes blood away from the heart? That's an artery. Okay, and then blood's going to flow into arterioles and capillaries, and it's going to return to the heart through a vessel we call a vein. That's right. And some veins are oxygenated and some veins are deoxygenated. You have to know a couple circulations as well. Okay, but just remember, an artery is always taking blood away from the heart and a vein blood toward the heart. The lymphatic system is kind of special. Okay, it only picks up fluid and delivers it toward the heart. So lymphatic system is acting kind of like a special vein. There is no such thing as like a lymphatic artery. Okay, so when blood is pumped into a capillary, there's a lot of fluid that leaves a capillary because this is where exchange takes place. And you remember from anatomy, capillaries are very thin-walled vessels. So exchange only takes place in capillaries, not in arterioles, arteries, venules, or veins because they're way too thick, too many layers. So a lot of fluid leaves the capillary on the proximal end, and on the distal end, it resorbs that fluid, but not all of it. Some of that fluid gets trapped in the tissue spaces, and it would stay there, and we'd get bigger and bigger and bigger every day, blow up like a balloon, maybe eventually explode or something, okay? But that excess fluid gets picked up by a lymphatic vessel, and it's returned to the heart via subclavian vein. So that's what the job of a lymphatic vessel is. There are other parts of the lymphatic system that have to do with producing an immune response. Sometimes it produces antibodies. Sometimes it produces contact killer cells that control these different things that we were talking about. Maybe it was on the previous slide. Yeah, like tumors and microorganisms and things like that. Okay, so the lymphatic system is kind of like a circulatory system. It doesn't carry blood, but it carries stuff we call lymph, which is the leftover fluid that's in the tissue spaces. So it's a lot like plasma. All right, so let's look at blood. Really close, right here, next time. Okay? All right, so take a look at this slide. It'll make Tuesday's lecture a whole lot more fun. What does it look like in terms of blood? How many main components does blood have? I see two right here. Yeah, read about those components in blood.